Headed to NVIDIA GTC? Visit Cool IT Systems at booth 1109 to see how they've been advancing liquid cooling with NVIDIA from 2009 to today and beyond. Ensure performance and reliability for your next-gen AI systems with the world leader in liquid cooling. Learn more at coolitsystems.com.
Last year, we had $3 billion of new investment in those startups. If you want a GPT-3 class model today, the inference cost is 1,200 times less than it was a year ago. Everybody wants a finger in every pie, just in case. Like, say, analog computing, there's optical computing, neuromorphic computing, CGRAs, quantum, adiabatic computing, biological computing. All of these are in one state or another, and everybody... Is the future of the machine learning market GPU or ASIC? Because right now we have a lot of the cloud service providers building their own silicon.
From Orion X in association with Inside HPC, this is the At HPC podcast. Join Shaheen Khan and Doug Black as they discuss supercomputing technologies and the applications, markets, and policies that shape them. Thank you for being with us.
Hi, everyone. This is the At HPC podcast. I'm Doug Black at Inside HPC. With me, of course, is Shaheen Khan of OrionX.net. And our special guest today is Dr. Ian Cutress. He is chief analyst at More Than More, a consulting firm that works with semiconductor companies. He's also host of the popular YouTube channel Tech Tech Potato. Prior to launching More Than More, Ian, for 11 years, was a senior editor at Anantech, a semiconductor technology review and news site. Ian, welcome.
Thanks, Doug. Thanks, Shaheen. Great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for being here. I have to say that when you were on Anantech, you were one of the must-read folks that I always tracked, and I was delighted when you went to More Than More. We're going to have to talk about Moore's Law, I'm sure. But anyway, delighted that you're here. Thank you for making it work.
It's been almost 3 years to the day.
Wow.
Congratulations.
Wow. Crazy. Thank you.
Very much. Well done.
So Ian, we understand you were just at the big ISCC conference, and there was a lot of discussion and news coming out of Intel and TSMC about the future of process node technology. What were some of the trends and news that you picked up there?
Yeah, so ISCC, International Solid State Circuits Conference, every year held downtown San Francisco, a chance for industry and academics to show off the latest and greatest in circuit design. As opposed to IEDM held in December, which is devices. This year, the conference as a whole, as is usually the case, these conferences are getting bigger and bigger and bigger each year, it seems. Almost 3,000 people, 39 tracks, I think, at the end, over 4 days. Lots and lots of people discussing analog and SerDes connectivity, how to get it lower power, how to get it faster or in both dimensions or on newer process nodes. I think the highlight for me was the section entitled SRAM. Now, in my day-to-day, one of the things I am keenly tracking is how process nodes compete against each other. We've got TSMC that have been on a tear in recent years, providing everybody with the latest and greatest. Intel, you know, the former incumbent, now playing catch-up. Samsung exists somewhere in the middle, and then we have, you know, GlobalFoundries and a few other players. But it's really Intel versus TSMC, with Intel's previous CEO, Pat Gelsinger, and his famous 5 nodes, 4 years. I bet the company on 18A, this next generation process node that's due to enter high volume manufacturing at the end of this year. There were two papers, one from TSMC and one from Intel, directly one after the other, about their newest process node technology. So for Intel, that's called 18A. A means angstrom, but as I'm sure your listeners know, these aren't real dimensions. These are just proper nouns, node names. So that's Intel's 18A versus TSMC N2 or 2 nanometer class design. Now, one of the big discussion points was whether Intel's 18A was going to catch up with the performance of TSMC N2. And we actually got a good hint of that at the conference. What the two papers showed in this session is that they were comparing SRAM densities, so L1, L2, L3 caches on die SRAM densities for high density and high performance designs. And to the fourth decimal place, it turns out they're identical.
Wow, that's news.
so So both companies were showing off 38.1 megabit per square millimeter density. And just for comparison, 7 nanometer is around about the 20 to 22 megabit per square millimeter. So despite what everybody is saying about the difference between logic and memory scaling as we advance to new process nodes, according to TSMC, Moore's Law is still alive.
They've been saying that for a few years.
Yeah, you know, compared to Jensen, who says Moore's Law is dead.
Well, I mean, Moore's Law was supposed to be about transistor density on a two-dimensional surface.
Mm.
That does seem to have plateaued, if not stopped. And I think just by going 2.5D, 3D, that's how they get more transistors. But it's no longer per square inch. It's more like per cubic inch. Isn't that true?
Kind of. In this case, these two papers at the conference were specifically talking about a two-dimensional fixed area and an increase in density in SRAM, which historically hasn't showed, or people have promoted it as not being scaling as well as it should have done. But yeah, both companies were showing off some ways in which they've enabled this SRAM. The key difference between the two is that Intel, with its 18A process node, is introducing its power via technology. So this is the technique known as backside power delivery. Both companies are enabling gate-all-around transistors, but backside power delivery will be an Intel-only design when they launch 18A. So that was a major difference between the two. Intel is technically ahead on the technology, even if both densities are the same.
So Ian, it sounds, I would say my quick impression is you're pretty impressed with what Intel's doing there.
I am somebody who loves competition. Competition breeds innovation, and you put people in a box and they will innovate. The fact that both companies are now square equal in their densities for their high density designs, we just have to wait and make sure that the rest of Intel's process node is similarly competitive. And that's been the bulk of like the post-conference discussion after we've gone through the nitty-gritty of these two papers, is it's whether the rest of Intel's process node can deliver the next generation of chips, because Intel is promising to come to market about a year sooner with its 18A versus TSMC's N2.
Do you have thoughts on how this comes to bear on this widely rumored talk of breaking the company up, acquisition of the foundry business, and so forth?
Yeah, I've had for a long time now, and I know Shaheen has heard this a few times, Intel can't spin off its foundries right now. I mean, they could do a partial IPO to gain some value out of that side of the business, but they can't split. And there's a very distinct reason. Most of Intel's foundries right now build Intel 14 nanometer, 10 nanometer, and 7 nanometer chips. In order to build those at Intel, the design tools to design the chips, typically we refer to this in the industry as the EDA tools, the electronic design automation tools.
Yeah.
Rather than using industry standard Synopsys and Cadence tools, which everybody else uses, Intel uses their own for 14, 10, and 7. And those tools aren't available externally to foundry customers. That means in order to keep those fabs up and running and producing chips and profitable, they can only process Intel's own designs. So if you split and say have a wafer agreement between foundry and product, the value is there is next to nil, because if product suddenly didn't want to use 14, 10, and 7, sure, there'd be a wafer agreement to get money back. But then you'd end up with a foundry company that can't produce anything for anyone else either. Unlike AMD split with Global Foundries very quickly transitioned to a industry standard mechanism, and they had most of that in place anyway. Intel's newer process nodes, Intel 3 and Intel 18A, are all fully, essentially 99.99% industry standard. So they're open for foundry, but that's only one or two of Intel's fabs worldwide can manufacture that technology. So the split would only happen post 2027, because this is a time we expect a industry standard design kit for 14, 10, and 7 to be made available. Until then, I don't think the foundry has any value externally.
Yeah, I think they're pretty baked.
Ian, would you be comfortable talking about the departure of Gelsinger, what led to it?
Yeah, I can speak to this, though I should stress that this is mostly personal opinion. I have almost no additional insight into what's already out there, if anybody's been following it that closely. It did seem immediate. I mean, I've known companies who have changed CEOs and internally they've had a day's notice. I'm not sure that most of Intel had even a day's notice at this point. When Pat left, I saw the email and I instantly got up and went and live streamed about that with my colleague George Cosma from Chips and Cheese, because it's such a monumental event. He was installed post Bob Swan after what was essentially a search that yielded no CEO. I'm under the impression he was actually offered it after Brian Krzanich left. And he said, well, I need to do this. And here's his five-year plan, his manifesto. And the board said no. Though 2 years later, they came crawling back, it seems, to say yes. And Pat was under the impression that he would be able to see out his plan, right? Pat is Intel through and through. He bleeds blue. Started there at age 18, worked his way all the way up through the company to reach a CTO on the product side. You know, helps design USB and Itanium and a number of other things. So the fact that he left in an instant, in the same way that a few months later, Lip Bhutan from Alden International left the board almost unexpectedly 3 months prior, makes me feel like that in some way those may be connected. And here's my conspiracy theory, if you'll allow me to indulge.
Please, go ahead.
So there is a suggestion, and this hasn't been confirmed publicly by Intel, not by any stretch, that the chairman of the board, Frank Yeary, may be going around Washington, D.C., trying to, quote-unquote, offload, as you said, Doug, to other companies or extract value from foundry and product to other people. If this is true, I wonder if Frank was doing that back in August, and that's what caused Lip-Bu to leave. Then in September, we had a major board meeting, and then come December, it gets too much for Pat, and Pat says, I don't want you to split it up. And Frank turns around and says, tough, we need to do this to save the company. And so Pat says, well, I'm out of here then.
Yeah, that was more or less my guess as well. Also not having any info from any source at all.
It feels like he wasn't allowed to execute his vision the way he needed to.
Because he was consistent in saying it's going to take 5 years, and like 3 years in, they lost appetite.
Or the money was starting to run out. That's also another factor. But the proof will be in the pudding. When Intel 18A hits the shelves, the first product we believe will be Intel's Panther Lake, which will ramp through the second half of 25. Then we'll have Intel's Clearwater Forest, which is a Xeon-based product, E-core-based product, coming out the first quarter of 2026. They've announced that. These will be the first, you know, real-world examples of whether that process node that Pat Gelsinger bet the company on is competitive against the competition. And there's a lot in the industry who appreciated Pat Gelsinger in his tough position, who want to see him proved right.
But how's it different now? What are they doing now that they couldn't do under Pat?
I don't know, to be honest, because what they're doing now feels almost like a holding pattern. Now, they have two co-CEOs interim, Michelle Johnson-Holthouse, who's also CEO of product, and David Zisner, who's also the CFO. I know both of them. Michelle's great.
Both well regarded, yeah.
Yeah, Michelle knows and understands product almost better than anyone, how she's come up through the organization. Dave has been criticized for sounding as if he's overworked. But whenever I've had discussions with him during analyst calls, he's always very open. It feels to me he doesn't hide anything when we have those discussions. So while Intel is in good hands, they do need a CEO to right the ship. One question has been asked is if the chairman of the board really is going around trying to partition bits of Intel off, can he do that without a permanent CEO in place?
Right.
And I've not found an answer to that.
Well, certainly less drama without one.
That's true. There was a rumor going around that GlobalFoundries CEO, Dr. Tom Caulfield, might take that position.
He took himself out, right?
Well, he was stepping down from the CEO of GlobalFoundries role. I think that takes effect 1st of April. Or the end of April. He's moving to chairman of the board, which GlobalFoundries have told me is going to be his full-time role. There is another stock situation. Some people noticed that almost $200 million of shares, or $176 million, were sold around the time of GlobalFoundries' announcement. And that is roughly the same amount as Gelsinger's compensation package.
Wow.
When he took over the job. So people are putting two and two together and getting somewhere between pi and five.
Ian, is it fair to ask 5 years from now, your sense of Intel, an overall picture?
Best case, Intel product and Intel foundry are competitive. TSMC is likely still going to be the major foundry leader, but people will have more confidence in Intel foundry. People already have confidence in Intel packaging, advanced packaging. The question is, can Intel bring that to Foundry customers on a competitive node? Worst case, we get a split and everything gets mothballed. This has been suggested that if Intel were to split and or essentially offer partial IPO of different business units, like what they're doing with Altera and Mobileye, but instead do it to Foundry and product, nobody's going to buy a Broadcom Core Ultra 9 285K. Moreover, Broadcom won't want a consumer product line, so they would mothball certain product lines that, even if they are the cash cows. It's that sort of rhetoric that's echoing in these circles right now. Though, I guess when this podcast goes live, that may have died down a bit if there's no added fuel to the fire.
What about their 14A fab?
So they are building out some of the fabs to bring high volume to 18A, 14A. 14A is expected to offer a high NA EUV variant, so using the latest generation technology from ASML. Right now, there have been no serious announcements or roadmaps on the future of that process node, just that they're going to be offering differentiated versions of both 18 and 14, and then whatever comes beyond. I guess one question to ask is, will they keep the same rate of pace of updates in process node technology? And to be honest, it's hard to do it as fast as they're doing it. You need the people in place, you need them in their long term, you need consistency. Kudos on the 18A development. Any new CEO that comes in, I'm not going to say is going to have to stay in Top Gear, but is at least going to have to keep their foot down in a lot of aspects in order to remain competitive for as long as they can.
Are we going to see their glass substrate?
Glass substrate, I hope so.
You liked it. I know when they announced it, that was a pretty cool thing.
So the things that get me up in the morning in this industry is when you can showcase something like glass core substrate. And I know that there's so much research that goes behind it that they don't want to talk about it yet. And I want to tease every little bit of information out of them.
They also talked about this directed self-assembly thing. I don't know whether that was part of 18 or 14.
Yeah, DSA has been in the literature for a while. It gets more complex as you go to smaller process nodes and how you implement it. It's going to be one of those, you know, gen-on-gen improvements that if it works and you can do it at scale, it provides extra benefit to performance or yield or power. Mm-hmm. You know, just like high-K and strained silicon and moving to FinFET has done back in the day, every process node right now, you know, has lots and lots of little enhancements like that to improve it on the line. The thing that didn't help Intel when it was during its 10 nanometer run is that they tried to do too much at once. TSMC's right now, it's the king of doing it a small steps at a time. And eventually you do enough small steps, you get a big step. Intel's now following that with its process node flow.
There you go.
So Ian, we're moving toward GTC, AI and GPUs are, you know, the big thing going on these days. Maybe sticking with Intel, what's your overall sense of Intel in GPU technology? They had Falcon Shores change in status recently. Are they riding the ship on GPUs? Is this more of the same? What do you think of the direction they're going?
I think there's a delineation here, the difference between GPUs and AI. Because of NVIDIA and AMD, we kind of lump it all into the same bucket. Intel's past is littered with the corpses of high-end performance silicon projects that it's cancelled over time. And Falcon Shores becomes, even though it's relegated to test chip status, is another one of those announcements. So people look ahead towards their next generation Falcon Shores and if it's at the right time. If we specifically speak about the AI business, last year, I think, you know, in the last 12 months, NVIDIA has made somewhere close to $100 billion on AI silicon as part of that business. AMD has made over $5 billion in that business. Intel last year failed to reach $500 million. So less than 10% of the revenue of AMD on their AI silicon through a mixture of delays or design or inoperability between software packages or just not having a good proposition or just fighting against an extremely strong incumbent, whichever way you look at it. Intel has acquired 3 AI hardware companies over the years, 2 for enterprise, 1 for consumer. The consumer one's still going, and that's in their consumer products, and that's working fine. But on the enterprise side, between Nervana, the first acquisition, and Habana, the second one, I made a recommendation in Intel's Q3 financials last year that, given the state the company is in the same way that Intel kind of lost smartphone, maybe they've lost AI in this case. Mm-hmm. And given how much they've invested, you know, it's sunken cost at this point. Maybe it's a case of let's stay away from the hardware, focus on the software, and then at a point where we become more financially stable on our feet, then we acquire somebody worth acquiring with a technology that's more integrated into the community. There are other experts who can do this. Intel disagrees. That's why Gaudi 3 is ramping, though the appetite for Intel's AI business is relatively low. They have some installations in the thousands of GPUs, thousands of chips. But yeah, how they're going to continue that momentum as AMD iterates through MI350, MI400, as NVIDIA iterates through Blackwell, Blackwell Ultra, Rubin, Rubin Ultra, it's unclear right now. That being said, Intel's desktop GPU business for gamers is going great.
They've always been strong there, have they not? An integrated GPU, I mean.
They have hundreds of millions of integrated units, but they had issues when scaling up that design into a more desktop class, sort of in the 150 to 300 watt range just for graphics. Mm-hmm. They did launch their Battlemage GPUs for that market in December last year at a price point that made them sell out. For the performance for dollar, it's a price point that AMD and NVIDIA just aren't focusing on right now. So they're going great guns, and that got a great response. Whether they've made any money from it, given the multi-year investment it's taken, it's unclear right now.
So AMD has a 5% market share, basically, in GPUs for enterprise AI. Is that a fair, am I capturing that correctly?
Yeah, it's about that. I did see some analysts claim that that is actually a reduction than over the last couple of quarters. Simply because NVIDIA's sales have been sky high.
They're growing so fast, right?
Yeah. I think I did the math in that last year, 24, NVIDIA sold 6 million AI GPUs. AMD sold about 200,000 max.
Yeah, that's a bigger ratio than the aggregate numbers last year.
Yes.
Yeah. So what do you expect at GTC? Should we expect the 500 kilowatt rack?
Yeah. The big thing last year, wasn't it, with GTC, that they announced the 120 kilowatt Blackwell rack, and everybody turned around and said, well, hang on, my colo does maximum 12 kilowatts per rack, or 25 if it's AI, 50 if it's a new build. How the hell are you going to do 120 with a design? I think the thing is, it's been a year since then. We expected Blackwell and the NVL72 to ship 4 months ago, 5 months ago. However, it's only this week, in this past week, that HPE's Trish Damkroger has said that they're finally shipping NVL72.
Yeah.
We know that they've had some delays in the packaging and in the thermals, and TSMC's even admitted this, to get that product to date, get it out the door, essentially. Supermicro also confirmed that they're now shipping.
Yeah, I've seen it this past month. I think Supermicro and Dell were a little bit ahead of HPE, perhaps.
Mm.
But yeah. It's all been within the past month, let's say.
So, yeah, and the next one on that roadmap is obviously Blackwell Ultra, the higher memory capacity version. That's expected to increase the power per rack as well. Though what's interesting, and I wonder if NVIDIA will talk about this at all, or whether we're still a year away, is that our friend Dylan Patel at SemiAnalysis posted numbers for how much power a Rubin rack.
Right.
And a Rubin Ultra rack. I believe the numbers were around 303 kilowatts a rack for Rubin and 819 kilowatts for a Rubin Ultra rack.
I see. Okay. So on average, 500.
Jensen was right last year when he said, if you're going to go build an AI factory, today you're going to populate it with what we have available. And next year, you'll just buy some more of that. And the year after you'll buy some more of that, you'll still keep the stuff you have. However, when it comes to building out the infrastructure, we know that Microsoft and Meta and Elon and his companies and all the other CSPs, they're looking for power, they're looking for space. I believe at one point Meta mothballed a new data center that they were in the process of building because the architecture of the data center was already too old by the time the data center was half built.
Oh, interesting.
So in order to optimize for power and data and throughput and all the other metrics that data centers need, they decided to pull the building down and start building a new one more designed for compute of the future.
So do you buy this notion that in a post-Moore's Law world, you just stay with the gear that you bought and you're not going to salivate over the latest greatest, even though it might have more of this and less of that?
Well, I think a limiting factor is, can you even get hold of the latest and greatest? With the big companies right now committing to, you know, Microsoft is $80 billion of CapEx and other CSPs are, you know, either approaching that number, and China's doing what China does, and that's another, you know, fly in the ointment of what's happening over there. The lead times for NVIDIA hardware right now, the latest I heard was around 52 to 60 weeks.
Yeah that's what, for Blackwell, yeah.
Yeah. So, but if you want an AMD system, it's half that. Well, if you want an Intel system, you can get one today. The question is the market moving quick enough, and can companies be more agile enough to leverage the benefits of this silicon, or sit on their hands and wait? And FOMO is massive right now. Nobody wants to sit and wait.
Right. But I mean, that's one side, which I agree, and we see that as well. But there's also the notion of, at some point, where's the beef? Is this stuff making me money? And is presumably AI really isn't making money. I think Satya was quoted as saying we need to some kind of a cautionary tone anyway. How do you see that? Is this just going to be FOMO forever? Because
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. And it's a question that investors ask me from time to time as well. Does AI as a service really exist? And is it just a race to the bottom in terms of costs, but then also a race to the top when it comes with compute, with agentic workflows, with larger models and such? And the way I frame it is in two factors. The main two ways of generating revenue, one is simply scale. If you're, I mean, we're taking research out of the equation here and just looking at, you know, revenue of what's available. If you look at OpenAI and their subscription model, it is making money, but the company is spending so much money in research, it looks like they're not making anything. But they're making billions of dollars with their infrastructure. Obviously, they've obviously had to build out billions and billions and lease billions to get there. But at a point over time, just in the same way that, I guess, the Uber effect, you come in, you undercut the competition, you provide a better service. Then when everything else disappears, you're the only game left in town.
Yeah, it used to be called dumping.
Yeah, but scale is a wonderful thing when you have a fixed cost enterprise, because you can just leverage your margins to, you know, and just keep growing and growing. The other side of the coin is highly focused and targeted AI and machine learning. And the one I usually quote for this is the consulting method. If you can go to one of your clients as a consultant, improve their productivity, either by directly increasing throughput or reducing baseline costs. Say you save a company $5 million in HR, for example, they don't care whether you're charging them $20 per million tokens or $2,000 per million tokens. All they see at the end of the day is they've got a baseline savings of X million dollars. So in reality, as a consultant company providing that infrastructure and service, you can sell those tokens, you can manufacture those tokens at, say, $4 per million, but then sell them at $2,000 per million tokens, then you've got a massive upside to your business. And this is something that IBM and other, you know, consultant companies like that are doing really well in. And they've got books of revenue in the billions for providing services like these in a very high margin environment. Now, you have to do the R&D to get there, to keep your costs low, to give you the value add. I think I saw a statistic that if you want a GPT-3 class model today, the inference cost is 1,200 times less than it was a year ago.
Wow. That's, and why not, is that just software or hardware or both?
So the models are better. that's a big part of that. So instead of GPT-3 was what, a 400 billion parameter model, or they never released a number, but it was, you know, up in the hundreds of billions. You can now get the same performance in certain benchmarks with a 2 billion parameter model. So your compute is lower, but also the efficiency cost of your compute is better. So it becomes a multiplicative factor. And the thing is, what's going to 1200x in the next 12 months? Is it going to be something like a DeepSeek? Is it going to be something like a hardware? Or are we going to have a new software revolution? Right now, it's unclear. I thought of an analogy the other day that I might use in future content. Back in the 80s, all we had was ASCII gaming. You know, can you do this little cursor on the screen? Nobody imagined the immersive VR experiences we have today that came 40 years later. So what's the 40-year horizon for machine learning in that context?
Oh, yeah, for sure. But I mean, even that sort of a gain within 12 months is enough to keep the FOMO mood alive.
Oh, of course. Yes. Yeah. If you built a product infrastructure based on GPT-3 then, you could easily be undercut by a new entrant today, unless you also did the transition and ensured that you kept consistency. Part of this is if you build a model and a business based on machine learning today, whatever hardware you use, whatever data centers you use, you have to make sure it's state of the art, and that's what's costing money.
What does 16 years of liquid cooling innovation with NVIDIA look like? See for yourself at Cool IT's booth 1109 at NVIDIA GTC. Check out Cool IT Systems' high-density liquid cooling technologies, optimized for current and next-gen NVIDIA platforms. Attend Cool IT's sessions to learn what it takes to cool today's most compute-intensive workloads and what's next for AI cooling infrastructure. Ensure performance and reliability for your next-gen AI systems with the world leader in liquid cooling. Visit coolitsystems.com to learn more.
Ian, you mentioned DeepSeek. What is your take on that?
Yeah, DeepSeek was a lot of hype and a lot of misunderstanding. And I guess my opinion has revised somewhat since it was announced. Initially, I was quite downbeat saying, what is everybody talking about? If this just makes it cheaper, everybody's going to use it more, which is true, called Jevons paradox, as opposed to Jensen's paradox, which is the more you buy, the more you save.
That is a paradox.
What DeepSeek were able to do, what the team were able to do, regardless of whatever infrastructure they had on the back end, is that they managed to implement several techniques that were in research. They managed to do it at an extremely low level and efficient compute. And they also introduced a few new techniques of their own. I mean, the OpenAI VP or C-suite executive turned around and said, oh yeah, no, they implemented a bunch of stuff we've also discovered. We just hadn't implemented it in a public product yet, right? So they were the first to market with a few techniques. They made it incredibly optimized. And as a result, we got the benefit that we saw in the papers, this whole lower cost of inference. Now, there is a couple of things to note here. The DeepSeek mixture of experts model is the biggest mixture of experts model on the market. A mixture of experts does have efficiency over a dense transformer like a GPT, or most of the, or Llama and some of those other open source benchmarks. So there is a benefit by just simply having a different architecture. Then optimizing it for a super low level. Then they also, because they were constrained by the networking of the chips they had in China, they had to rewrite the network stack in order to optimize communications. Now, that was something completely new, but it turns out, again, if you put people in a box, they will innovate. And they innovated around the area of GPU to GPU communication, latency and bandwidth. And now we can apply that. You know, if they open up and talk about what they did, I don't believe they have yet. That could provide new skills and new dimensions for us to focus on in the future with new models. And the thing is, the DeepSeek moment isn't going to be unique. There's going to be a ton of these going forward. The question is whether the media and the market are going to react in the same way and each time cut $500 billion off of NVIDIA's market cap. Part of it is education. And part of what I do day to day is try and help not only investors, but also engineers and other analysts understand what's going on such that it isn't just a, you know, one and done situation with things like DeepSeek.
they're still going to overreact. I think that's another characteristic of the market.
Investors will.
Well, right, because they can't arbitrate. They don't know, and they have to be,
There's two types of investors. There's the tech investors and who play against the tech, and then there's the market investors who play against the market. And the market investors will be fooled every time.
And then you buy the dip on the dip and all that stuff. So, so looking at GTC, being there last year, I mean, it was not only just so crowded and oversubscribed, you might say overattended, and I've never been to a keynote that filled a professional sports arena, and it was almost euphoric. Do you think that same sense will be in place this year? I kind of doubt that, but also, what do you think will be the driving, maybe the big news coming out of the conference?
I expect the same thing to happen this year. Jensen's profile has only increased. So last year it was at the San Jose Convention Center, which doesn't fit 20,000 people. And this year we'll probably get more than 20,000 people attend. Jensen has done other large keynotes in stadiums of a similar nature. We saw that at Computex, we saw that at CES. And they just keep getting bigger. It reminds me back in, I think, 2014, 2015, I was at a Samsung keynote at Mobile World Congress where they were doing one of their first virtual reality or, you know, glasses. And they gave everybody in the stadium one of these, you know, headsets to play out part of the presentation. Then when everybody took the headset off, Mark Zuckerberg was on stage. And immediately all a bunch of photographers, mostly from the Asian press, decided just to bum rush the stage to get a picture with him. And that's what Jensen has right now. It's that cult of personality. So it almost doesn't matter what he's going to announce. That being said, one of the big things I think people are looking forward to is actual real world results on Blackwell and showing what markets is going to be used for. I have a strong feeling this conference is going to be heavily robotics focused. Jensen has been a champion of putting AI into robotics. It's the perfect example of an agentic mixture workflow that brings together many, many compute disciplines. So I expect to see another bump on that side. Because it's an embedded market, it will be a slow burn compared to some of the other large language model type announcements. And then it's just going to be a case of building the partnership, building the ecosystem. As we're recording this, NVIDIA's financial end of year financials are tomorrow. I was actually going through my numbers and they've been on a revenue increase like no other.
Incredible, yeah.
But it's also consistent. And if you look at what they're predicting for what they're going to announce tomorrow when this is recorded, it's still the CAGR is there. The annual growth in the revenue is there. So come GTC, there may be a bit more emphasis on networking. Actually, today we saw an announcement of NVIDIA with Cisco. So there's going to be some custom Cisco silicon in NVIDIA Spectrum X Ethernet switches. And Cisco is going to be the only partner to be able to do that. At CES earlier this year, we saw NVIDIA Digits, this small little ARM Core plus Blackwell GPU mini PC for $3,000, designed essentially the Mac Mini, but NVIDIA.
The Mac Mini, that's right.
And that is actually co-designed with MediaTek, funnily enough. So I expect to hear more about what they're going to be doing for developers, because that may very well be the first time a lot of developers experience Blackwell through one of those systems. So there's going to be a lot going on. I think the venue is insufficient for the amount of people that will attend easily. So it's funny. Last year, I got a tour of NVIDIA's campus, and there was plenty of room there.
There was plenty of what?
Room at NVIDIA's campus.
They also have had a very enlightened view of remote work, unlike many companies that are repelling their best and brightest by demanding that they show up. I think they've been pretty relaxed about it.
Well, whenever I hear a CEO or a boss complain about working from home and back to the office, I just turn around and say, you do realize there's a $3 trillion company that still has 100% work from home policy, except for certain specific roles. But other than that, it's pretty much all 100% work from home.
Yeah.
Or exactly, or whatever you want, right? And that I think has worked, and they are able to attract the best and brightest, and they execute like crazy. So clearly that's the case.
I mean, the benefit of working at NVIDIA right now, I think, is the stock options. Because when I did have that tour, I did ask my guide about what benefits do employees have. And apparently Jensen has this policy: you only get two things for free at NVIDIA, the air and the caffeine. So you can get a coffee anytime you want, but at the canteen, you still have to pay for.
Yeah, I think their canteen is subsidized, but not free. Yeah.
Sure, sure.
So there's some benefit there. And of course, the office is beautiful and the food is great and the environment is fantastic. And maybe it's a good time to talk a little bit more specifically about software, both AI software, HPC software, etc. So NVIDIA obviously is expanding into software. Initially, it was just CUDA and libraries that went with it. Then it was Omniverse, and then it's now Enterprise AI, and they've been making acquisitions. They talked about NIM last year, which was quite fantastic, and I think it accelerates application development by quite a lot. Where do you see that going next?
It's funny, because a friend once told me, or maybe this is a saying in the industry, I can't remember, hardware company can't sell software, and a software company can't sell hardware. However, NVIDIA is the exception.
Yes.
They're building software into its own revenue model. But I think the big thing here is that it essentially guarantees vendor lock-in. This is something we criticized Intel for decades about, especially when it first introduced AVX 512 into its processors when AMD had no equivalent. If you can build a software package, build a set of libraries, build a service that is reliant purely on your hardware, and then you can go sell that, you can lock in a customer for 5 to 10 years, because the effort needed to get out of that is double, triple, 10x. So on the NVIDIA side, we've often heard stories that NVIDIA is now 60% software engineers, 65% software engineers, and I believe it. I often state that one of the reasons that AMD is playing catch up is the fact that their portfolio is so much wider from a hardware perspective. Mm-hmm. But if you look at NVIDIA from a software perspective, they want to play in every vertical, at every layer of the stack. They want to be your best friend, because if they're your best friend, then you will use their hardware, and that's where a lot of the margin is.
Yeah, right on. I mean, they have their own everything. They have their own driverless car software, their own LLM, their own weather forecasting. And I think they have a really interesting model to say that, come learn from us. This is like a reference mm-hmm. architecture. And even their DGX is more of a recipe, right? Because as far as I know, you can't actually buy it directly from NVIDIA.
Yeah. I mean, name one other company that feels as vertically integrated as NVIDIA. And you'd probably say Apple. Though you're obviously Apple, a different market. Yeah. I mean, one of my claims to fame is that I took the first ever CUDA course outside the US. Back in 2009, they gave a bunch of money to the mathematical finance professor and a few GPUs and said, go teach a course. So I went, and the guy was, you know, really smart, but almost felt like he was a couple of chapters ahead in the teaching manual every time. So when I went to the same course the second year, it was much more refined. And, you know, that just goes to show that NVIDIA placed a bet on education, enabling CUDA and, you know, to a certain extent PTX in the HPC community that long ago. It comes down to, you'd never know what tools you create will be used for. Mm-hmm. And then this magical workload called AI and machine learning came around and has blown the top off their market cap, and everybody else is playing catch up while NVIDIA is doubling down to stay ahead. I actually was going through NVIDIA's financials in preparation for their new earnings. And actually, as a percentage of revenue, their spending on R&D has gone down considerably over 3 years. And that may be because they're making too much money and can't spend
it. Yeah, the revenue has been going up so much.
It used to be somewhere in the 30%, and now it's about 10%. So
yeah, 10% is already like higher than industry average.
Yeah, it's more revenue than its competitors.
In absolute terms, yeah. It's huge, of course. So.
And in absolute terms, it's huge. That's right. Now, how about the next tier of GPU providers who are doing really cool stuff? Cerebras does, and Samba Nova. And we talked about Graphcore having been acquired by SoftBank in our pre-call. Mm-hmm. Grok seems to be doing really well.
Yeah, I've been tracking the AI hardware startups quite a lot over the last few years.
Oh, you kind of come up with vendors that nobody knows even exist that they're doing stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, it's. I think my list is over 100 these days. But I track around $17 billion of investment across the companies that I target. Most of them are AI. Some of them are very much AI adjacent, like optical connectivity companies. But last year, we had $3 billion of new investment in those startups. Grok had $690 million in a Series D. TensTorrent had $693 million in a Series D. Light Matter had $400 million. IR Labs had $155 million. And a bunch of other sort of smaller startups had anywhere between $20 and $50 million. We've had a couple of exits, as you said. Graphcore was sold to SoftBank. That's effectively an exit. Blaze, which is an edge AI company, did a SPAC, a sort of reverse acquisition, and which doesn't tend to go down too well. Apparently, they only had $15,000 worth of hardware sales or $50,000 worth of hardware sales previous year. We saw two Korean companies merge. We're starting to see some consolidation, basically, but we're also seeing an increased rate of investment, which is really interesting. And among those players, we've seen one or two companies start to get revenues that match their investment rate. The one I often highlight is Cerebras. They've essentially generated $1 billion worth of book revenue, which is going to filter in over time to go beyond what their investment is. Now, you could argue that purchase was made by one of the investors, but revenue is revenue.
Grok, the G42?
Yes, that's the G42. Grok announced that they've got a $1.5 billion arrangement, again, with another Middle Eastern deployment company, though it's unclear whether that's direct revenue or that's the value of the entire project for everybody involved. I haven't spoken to the CEO about that recently. I need to, but we're getting into a spot now where a lot of these hardware startups are in the sort of 5, 6, 7, 8 years old now. They've had a burn rate. They need to start producing. They need to start getting some pickup. And to be honest, most of the CSPs are engaged with most of them, those who are data center focused, at least, because everybody wants a finger in every pie just in case. If I take the investment into IR Labs, so IR Labs is an optical connectivity company. They're developing point-to-point optics for GPU or AI chip-to-chip, but also chip-to-memory or system-to-system. So, you know, shorter range optics for the data center. So instead of having an 8-way GPU cluster, you have a 512-way GPU cluster. Their funding round, the biggest investors there were AMD, Intel, and NVIDIA.
Pretty good. Interesting.
For Light Matter, it was Google Ventures.
Right.
You know, so everybody's getting involved in as much as they can, at least in a super small way. Because even if they're only offering a financial, not a technical investment, if it gets to the point where it matters, then they can come in and say, hey, actually, we want to have a technical engagement with you. And so that's also fueling a lot of the growth in the startup market today. Exactly who will win? I mean, I could pick apart pretty much every company we've mentioned, plus a few others about where their strengths and weaknesses lie. I think over the next 12 months, we're going to see a number of companies come out with new chips, which will make or break those companies. So, for example, Grok currently has a GlobalFoundries 12-nanometer chip that's quite power-hungry, and you need racks and racks to do a 70-billion parameter model. But the next generation is on Samsung 4-nanometer, and I believe will have stacked DRAM. It's that sort of thing that's going to be coming out.
And then you get folks like Sambanova, Mythic, LightSolver, and that causes me to ask you both about FPGA, and you mentioned analog in the ISCC conference and mixed signal. Where do you see that? There's like a lot of potential there for especially this kind of a long pipeline execution that LLMs can be. And some people are using it, Grok too, really effectively. But let's talk a little bit about that.
It's funny enough, I'm actually meeting up with Sambanova tomorrow because I haven't actually met their technical team yet. However, I've attended so many of their presentations over the years. It all comes down to non-von Neumann architectures, I think. Mm-hmm. Right now, with the standard computing paradigm, there are limits on power consumption and how much energy per operation, how much energy per bit in data transfer, especially with the movement to chiplets in the industry. You can't move data between chiplets without taking a power penalty compared to a monolithic piece of silicon. So there's a lot of new and innovative ways in not only the compute, but also the memory and the packaging. And that's why we're also getting yet a number of these startups coming to play. Analog comes in two forms in this context. What I saw at the conference was mostly connectivity analog, just getting the lowest energy per bit transferred across a connection, whether that's electrical, whether it's optical, whether it's UCIe, but then also maintaining high bandwidth. So it's not only 50 gigabit per second, but 100 or 200 or beyond, and whether that's NRZ or PAM4 or PAM6. Or I saw optical QAM16 as well being trialed at the conference. So a lot of that's going on. When it comes to analog compute, I mean, this is a relatively old idea, you know, older than I've been alive, a good, you know, 40, 50 years. And one of the key issues with analog is just maintaining manufacturing consistency. Analog has had a number of successes in the edge market. And the failures we hear about are when people want to do analog in the data center at scale with these large LLMs, because we haven't figured out how to scale these designs or have the right level of digital to analog or analog to digital converters. You know, it's like quantum computing. It requires a full ecosystem in order to support it. So right now we're seeing ideas that have merit, but don't have necessarily the infrastructure to scale in the same way a standard GPU or a standard digital compute chip might. Now, will that change in the future? I mean, like I say, analog computing is optical computing, neuromorphic computing, CGRAs, quantum, adiabatic computing, biological computing. All of these are in one state or another, and everybody's trying lots of different things. And a lot of it is in base research right now. And what happens, like, for example, with Mythic, is that eventually one of these academics gets enough money to go and try and make a commercial device. And if there's one thing I've learned with academics, is that if they don't have the right team around them to go to market, they end up 6 years into a startup with nothing to show for it. Great research, no product.
Oh, you have to actually engineer it. Yeah.
You have to actually sell it.
Yeah. Ian, you mentioned IR Labs. We do cover photonic IO, if that's the right term, silicon photonics. How far from commercial readiness is that technology?
Yeah, a lot. It's great. I actually had a conversation with AMD's Sam Nafziger about this at the conference. He just happened to be in the demo room, and I collared him for 20 minutes because it's a question that comes up a lot when I speak with investors as well. I mean, so part of the problem right now is simply scaling up manufacturing. We have technologies that do point-to-point optical data transfer. We have it in chiplet form. We have the lasers, whether you believe we have it at the right power or the right bandwidth. For example, IR Labs is 4 terabits per second. They're going up to 8 terabits per second. Celestial AI believes that they can do hundreds of terabits per second. And I believe Litbu just invested in them or joined the board as well. Though when I was speaking to these companies, they talk about having an enablement in the sort of late 26 to 28 timeframe. So essentially at least 2 years out from today. However, one of the big complexity parts of this is that optics is a extreme cost add. So you're only going to do it to your high margin parts. But if you do it to your high margin parts, you have to put in a lot of R&D effort long term to make sure that you trying this new technology, it's stable and it works. So it came to mind that would a company build both an optical and an electrical version of their design? Is this something that chiplets helps enable or helps hinder? And I don't expect any company to build a 100% optical product without having an electrical backup. A standard point-to-point electrical backup. And I spoke to Sam from AMD about this, and you know, he's of the opinion, yeah, until it becomes a proven mass market adopted technology, people will hedge their bets. And that makes sense. When speaking with IR Labs, like I say, they believe they've got the technology down pat. And part of the build-up, this is why they've just done their funding round, is scaling up the manufacturing and ensuring manufacturing consistency and yield. I mean, NVIDIA's not going to put it on a product if you can't produce a million chiplets a month. Right. If you can only manufacture 10,000 today, that's not enough. Nobody's going to take a gamble. Jim Keller, our good friend and CEO over at TensTorrent, he told me that when you are a startup, you have to approach the industry as you can't just go straight after the million GPU systems. You have to start at the 100 and say, yeah, can I build 100? Let's go after customers who want 1,000. Can I build 1,000? Let's go after customers who want 10,000. Optical seems, because of the cost involved, but also the potential upside, it's something that has to jump up to at least mid to high level first before it filters back down and gets manufactured at cost. It drives down the cost over time.
Aren't they partnered with GlobalFoundries, I believe?
Yes, I believe they're using GlobalFoundries 45 nanometer optical technology. To be honest, that's really the only one in the market that makes sense right now. TSMC has COUP, which is their co-packaged optics. I know IMEC has like a 200 nanometer optics line that's used by companies like Quant as well. And Intel also has an optical side to their foundry. They haven't spoken about it much yet, though.
Well, they had a famous demo that Pat did early on with their silicon photonics.
Yeah, that was an acquisition they made with a company in Scotland showing pluggable optics. And because Intel is an investor in IR, I think that may be the same technology that IR is using.
I see. And then there's Light Matter and Avicenna and a few others, right?
Yeah, Light Matter's different. They're going after photonic interposers. So you can take your standard AI chip today, and instead of using a silicon interposer, use an optic interposer, save power, increase bandwidth, make the design quote-unquote simpler. And apparently they've productized it for one of their customers already. They showed a demo of this at Supercomputing 24.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Avicenna is different because most optic solutions we talk about today, they multiplex wavelengths of light over a wire. Avicenna are going after one specific wavelength of blue micro LED light and having bundles of hundreds of fibers. So you lose the complexity of having modulation and thermal variance because all you're relying on is a blue LED and then a detector at the other end. But you have to take into account the fact that it's not as area efficient as.
Interesting.
But it's a simpler design. But they are years behind the others, as far as I'm aware.
So I have just one more question, but it might involve a long answer, and we don't want to take your whole day.
No worries.
So my question is, AMD in the GPU market, you know, what are their objectives looking out 3 to 5 years, and do they have a path to get there? What is their path against this juggernaut, NVIDIA?
Yeah, it's hard to compete against somebody who can both outspend and outhire you. So you have to be innovative in every which way you can. Recently, Lisa did a fireside Q&A with AMD's analysts to answer a bunch of questions post the financial earnings, but also on the scope of 2025 and beyond. Everybody's wondering what AMD's goals are. You know, it's the basis of your question, really. And she had come out with a few things that are worth highlighting. First, I guess, is that the nature of machine learning is being driven towards system level design, not chip level design. So we've heard about design technology optimization for designing the chip, but when you have system technology optimization, maybe the design of the system can be optimized for specific workloads. So in this case, we've spoken about NVIDIA's Blackwell NVL72 full 120 kilowatt racks. AMD will be moving towards that level of design come, if not MI350, then MI400 over the next year or so. That's part of the reason why AMD acquired ZT Systems, their $5 billion acquisition last year, which incidentally, once they complete, they're going to divest from ZT Systems manufacturing facilities, and that will recoup about $4 billion. So they hired it for the expertise and the people and the design capabilities therein, but not necessarily the manufacturing. That's interesting. But one of the other things that 2025 for AMD, they're going to focus a lot on training. So 2024, they made big strides in inference workloads in machine learning, but so much so that OpenAI actually uses AMD's hardware for inference on GPT-4. because it's 10% cheaper than running it on NVIDIA. The problem, however, is that training is where a lot of the sales are today. This is what we've seen from the CSPs with their big clusters. So in order to get on that, AMD needs to make a concerted software effort to support training workloads and optimize it to perform better than competition. So 2025 is going to be the year that they're going to do that. They have customers who have been using the hardware for inference now for over a year, and those customers are now confident to turn around to say to AMD, what about training? So AMD is committed to working on training as its main software focus for 2025. And beyond that, obviously, dual-pronged strategy for as much as training is incredibly relevant. AMD also committed to providing a developer cloud. So the ability for developers to go and test the latest and greatest hardware without having to buy it. Intel has had this for a number of years now, especially key customers who want to trial run their new software built on future architecture designs, but need quote unquote behind the scenes access before installing it. So AMD is going to commit to going down that route. They did say it's not going to be necessarily an in-house developer cloud, but they will leverage their partners to provide resources, you know, and AMD is covering the cost or, you know, offer it as a service going beyond in the same way that Intel does. And realistically, NVIDIA has just relied on other clouds to do that right now. In terms of future-looking revenue for AMD, one of the big comments from 24 is that AMD kept upping their revenue estimate for their AI hardware from 1 billion to 2 to 4 to 5, and it ended up at 5 plus. Everybody asked, can you provide the same number for 2025? And Lisa, AMD CEO, said no, which really annoyed all the investors, but made the rest of us laugh. AMD is of the opinion now that it has scale, it has confidence in the market, and it's going to leverage that in order to go after customers. Lisa actually made a big comment in the back and forth about, is the future of the machine learning market GPU or ASIC? Because right now we have a lot of the cloud service providers building their own silicon, not only ARM CPU-based CPUs for the head nodes of their compute, but also AI accelerators. You know, we've got Microsoft Maya, we've got Graviton 4, we've got Google's Axion, we've got Trainium, Inferentia. You know, I've always said it doesn't take much to build an average chip, but if you want a really, really good chip, you need a design company in charge of doing it. AMD believes they have the expertise. But Lisa cited DeepSeek in this. She said the first thing that everybody wanted to do when DeepSeek came out and was open sourced, open weighted, is run it on their hardware. GPUs, from her perspective, are infinitely flexible for doing that. ASICs, not so much. And that's why you saw a lot of DeepSeek runs on GPUs before it got onto ASICs several weeks later. So from her perspective, it's also the fast iteration that the market needs is built upon GPUs. Not only that, but their main customers are the ones making their own silicon, and it ends up entirely being workload dependent from her perspective. Mm-hmm. But the market will be a rich mix of all these other hardwares and architectures. And that's also where a lot of the startups we mentioned earlier are trying to fit in. Everybody wants a piece of everything right now.
Right. But
AMD is going to continue on the cadence. They've spoken about essentially their architecture developments through to 2026. Going beyond that, there's questions, would AMD ever use Intel's process or Intel packaging? Is, you know, what's beyond HBM? When does optics fit into this? And right now, I think beyond mid-26 is a bit of an unknown right now.
Fascinating. Great discussion.
Excellent. Thank you, Ian. Thank you for making it happen. Thank you for staying late in the evening with the time difference that we have.
No worry.
Great conversation. Looking forward to seeing you in person.
I could talk about this stuff for hours, as you can probably gather.
We too, right? I mean, we should do one of these like 5-hour sessions then.
Very good. All right. Well, thanks so much.
Excellent.
Thank you for having me on.
Take care. Until next time.
That's it for this episode of the At HPC podcast. Every episode is featured on InsideHPC.com and posted on OrionX.net. Use the comment section or tweet us with any questions or to propose topics of discussion. If you like the show, rate and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. The At HPC podcast is a production of OrionX in association with Inside HPC.
Thank you for listening.